Hello, I'm Veronica Scarsbrick. Thanks for joining me. This week, as we know, Benedict XVI met with the bishops of England and Wales, led by the president of their bishops' conference, the Archbishop of Westminster, Vincent Nicholls. The bishops were in Rome on their ad limina visit and were received in audience by the Pope on Monday, 1st of February. On this occasion, the Pope spoke to them of his forthcoming apostolic visit to Great Britain, touching on many sensitive issues, but also highlighting in a special way the figure of an eminent Englishman who's soon to be beatified. He's Cardinal John Henry Newman, a man, the Holy Father remarked, who left us an outstanding example of faithfulness to revealed truth. Let's listen to what he said.
He left us an outstanding example of faithfulness to revealed truth by following the kindly light wherever it led him, even at considerable personal cost.
Benedict XVI then noted how Newman saw himself first and foremost as a priest, calling on the bishops present to hold him up to priests during this year dedicated in a special way to priesthood as an example of dedication to prayer, pastoral sensitivity towards the needs of his flock, and passion for preaching the gospel.
In Newman's words, Christ's priests have no priesthood but his. What they do, he does. When they baptize, he is baptizing. When they bless, he is blessing.
Well, attentive to Pope Benedict's words and in a tribute to Newman's scholarship and its writings, I want to stay tuned and join Jill Bevilacqua, who's taken the time to select some readings from this author for us.
John Newman spent the first half of his life as an Anglican and then became the most celebrated convert of his time. He was born in London in 1801. At the age of 15, he had what he later called an interior conversion, when he became convinced of the truth of the Christian revelation.
The Christian has a deep, silent, hidden peace which the world sees not. What he is, when left to himself and to his God, that is his true life. He can bear himself. He can, as it were, joy in himself, for it is the grace of God within him. It is the presence of the eternal Comforter in which he joys. He can bear, he finds it pleasant, to be with himself at all times, never less alone than when alone. He can lay his head on his pillow at night and own in God's sight with overflowing heart that he wants nothing, that he is full and abounds, that God has been all things to him, and that nothing is not his which God could give him. More thankfulness, more holiness, more of heaven he needs indeed, but the thought that he can have more is not a thought of trouble, but of joy.
Newman took Anglican orders and became a tutor at Oriel College, Oxford, and a famous university preacher. He was one of the founders of the Oxford movement. From the year 1838, Newman began to have doubts about the Anglican position. The following year, he had just completed a comprehensive reading of the Church Fathers.
Hardly had I brought my course of reading to a close when the Dublin Review of that same August was put into my hands by friends who were more favourable to the cause of Rome than I was myself. There was an article in it on the Anglican claim by Bishop Wiseman. It was on the Donatists, with an application to Anglicanism. I read it and did not see much in it. The Donatist controversy was known to me for some years. The case was not parallel to that of the Anglican Church. St. Augustine was in Africa and wrote against the Donatists in Africa. They were a furious party who made a schism within the African church and not beyond its limits. But my friend, an anxiously religious man, a Protestant still, pointed out the words of St. Augustine, which were contained in one of the extracts made in the review, and which had escaped my observation. Securus judicat orbis terrarum. He repeated these words again and again, and when he was gone, they kept ringing in my ears. The words of St. Augustine struck me with a power which I never had felt from any words before. They were like the turn again Whittington of the chime. They were like the tolle legge, take up and read, of the child which converted St. Augustine himself. By those great words of the ancient father, the theory of the via media was absolutely pulverized. I had seen the shadow of a hand upon the wall.
Newman's conversion was not immediate. He had no blinding flash of vision. As he wrote himself,
all the logic in the world would not have made me move faster towards Rome than I did. As well might you say that I have arrived at the end of my journey because I see the village church before me, as venture to assert that the miles over which my soul had to pass before it got to Rome could be annihilated, even though I had had some far clearer vision than I then had, that Rome was my ultimate destination. Great acts take time.
It took Newman another 6 years, towards the end of which he wrote his essay in the development of Christian doctrine, from which the celebrated phrase comes, "To live is to change, and to be perfect is to have changed often." In fact, Newman declared that he had begun this essay as an Anglican, but ended it as a Catholic. His doubts kept him company all the way.
My difficulty was this. I had been deceived greatly once. How could I be sure that I was not deceived a second time? I then thought myself right. How was I to be certain that I was right now? How many years had I thought myself sure of what I now rejected? How could I ever have confidence again in myself? To be certain is to know that one knows. What test had I that I should not change again after that I had once become a Catholic? I had still apprehension of this, though I thought a time would come when it would depart. However, some limit ought to be put to these vague misgivings. I must do my best and then leave it to a higher power to prosper it. So I determined to write an essay on doctrinal development, and then, if at the end of it my convictions in favor of the Roman Church were not weaker, to make up my mind to seek admission into her fold. I acted upon this resolution in the beginning of 1845, and worked at my essay steadily into the autumn. As I advanced, my view so cleared that instead of speaking any more of the Roman Catholics, I boldly called them Catholics. Before I got to the end, I resolved to be received, and the book remains in the state in which it was then, unfinished.
Just before he entered what he called the one fold of the Redeemer, Newman penned these words in conclusion to his essay.
Time is short, eternity is long. Put not from you what you have here found. Regard it not as mere matter of present controversy. Set not out resolved to refute it, and looking about for the best way of doing it. Seduce not yourself with the imagination that it comes of disappointment, disgust, or restlessness, or wounded feeling, or undue sensibility, or other weakness. Wrap not yourself round in the associations of past years, nor determine that to be truth which you wish to be so, nor make an idol of cherished anticipations. Time is short. Eternity is long.
When Newman was made a cardinal at the age of 78, he took the opportunity, in his speech of acceptance, to give voice to one of his favourite themes, the opposition of religious liberalism.
To one great mischief I have from the first opposed myself. For 30, 40, 50 years I have resisted to the best of my powers the spirit of liberalism in religion. Never did Holy Church need champions against it more sorely than now, when, alas, it is an error overspreading as a snare the whole earth. Liberalism in religion is the doctrine that there is no positive truth in religion, that one creed is as good as another, and this is the teaching which is gaining substance and force daily. It is inconsistent with any recognition of any religion as true. Men may go to Protestant churches or to Catholic. Men may get good from both and belong to neither. Religion is in no sense the bond of society. Instead of the church's authority, the philosophers and politicians would substitute, first of all, a universal and thoroughly secular education. As to religion, it is a private luxury, which a man may have if he will, but which, of course, he must pay for, and which he must not obtrude upon others or indulge into their annoyance. Such is the state of things, and I lament it deeply, because I foresee that it may be the ruin of many souls.
John Newman was a man of many parts, but one of his most attractive qualities was his gift for friendship. Here, in conclusion, he gives us his ideas on Christian friendship.
We find our Saviour had a private friend, and this shows us, first, how entirely he was a man, as much as any of us, in his wants and feelings. And next, that there is nothing contrary to the spirit of the gospel, nothing inconsistent with the fullness of Christian love, in having our affections directed in an especial way towards certain objects, towards those whom the circumstances of our past life or some peculiarities of character have endeared to us. There have been men before now who have supposed Christian love was so diffusive as not to admit of concentration upon individuals, so that we ought to love all men equally. And many there are who, without bringing forward any theory, yet consider practically that the love of many is something superior to the love of one or two, and neglect the charities of private life while busy in the schemes of an expansive benevolence, or of effecting a general union and conciliation among Christians. Now I shall here maintain, in opposition to such notions of Christian love, and with our Saviour's pattern before me, that the best preparation for loving the world at large, and loving it duly and wisely, is to cultivate an intimate friendship and affection towards those who are immediately about us.
And a big thank you there to Jill Bevilacqua, who took the time to select these readings from Cardinal John Henry Newman. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.